I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White. Joining me today from the SPCA serving Erie County are Chief Development Officer Kelly Wolf, Chief Strategic Officer Stephanie Pepper, and Rachel Terapacki, the Director of Programs at the Resource Council of Western New York. Thank you all for being on with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So Kelly and Stephanie, tell us a little bit about the SPCA serving Erie County.
So the SPCA serving Erie County has been in our community for over 150 years. And one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about the SPCA is we are truly committed to research-based programs that create long-lasting change and equity in our community. We want to be responsive to the community, and we've been evolving for 150 years to be responsive to the community. We're so much more than adoptions and where you go to get your new cat.
So in this evolution, you know, recognizing barriers faced by underserved communities, obviously it's nothing new, but it's been especially highlighted in this area after the Tops tragedy of May 14th. But let's talk about this topic, addressing veterinary care access on Buffalo's East Side, specifically the 14208 area, which is the Kingsley-Maston area. So why does this need exist, and how was it initially identified by the SPCA?
So a really brief shift in the SPCA over the last few years is before we used to just take in every animal that would come to us, and we shifted to a community model. So we want to look at why animals are coming to us in the first place and how can we keep pets with their people. And that's the core of our mission now. So as we looked at this, we saw that people couldn't afford vet care. And so they were bringing their dogs and cats to us because they had no other option, or they were evicted and they didn't have housing that they could find that would allow their animal to come to them. So we really started looking at the parts of Buffalo where the most people were coming to us and where they had the least amount of resources. And so that's what led us to applying for this grant for the PetSmart Charities. And Steph, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about, because you were there when we responded to the Tops tragedy and how we ended up in this neighborhood.
So after the Tops tragedy, our CEO, Kate Daly, said, you know, we need to be a part, we need to help the community, we need to support the community, more in fact, support. So we had food and pet supplies, and we helped provide that for the community. And the one thing she had stated was, if you are going, you are not leaving. You need to be a part of this community. And when the incubator grant came, you know, was possible, this is where we truly wanted to focus our time and support with that community.
What was the feedback from the community on that day that you initially showed up?
You know, I think obviously they were thankful. Pets are such an important part of people's lives. They provide, you know, loving, and they're, oh my gosh, here I am.
I mean, we're all, I think anyone you run into is probably a SPCA family, mine included.
So I think, you know, pets, again, are such an important part. And, you know, people have to make choices. Are they, when they are faced with barriers and financial barriers, are they able to feed themselves or their pets? And that's just not a choice we want people to have to make. So if we can help support them and provide food and supplies for their animals, then they can focus their time on themselves. So if we can just ease that piece.
And in addition, so we were already in this community, and when the PetSmart Charities Grant, the incubator grant came up, we really did a lot of research about what is the access in the community? What do people need? And I was shocked to find, because I'm not from Buffalo, that Buffalo is the third poorest city in the nation.
Unfortunately.
And I was also, in doing research to write this grant, startled to find that it's the East Side is, or I guess the city as a whole, is the 12th most segregated city in the country. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that, not being from here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really started looking at the systemic reasons that mm-hmm. that was, that the policies that were being put in place. And as the SPCA, you know, like I said, our mission is to keep pets with their people, but we really need key community partners who are already doing this work to get into the community, to gain the community's trust. And if I'm being frank, we were going in as law enforcement. We have a humane law enforcement officer team, and they were going in and they were taking animals. And when we were looking at, you know, who we want to be as an organization, we don't want to be a punitive organization. We don't want to punish people for poverty. That right. is not our mission. So we really had to look at, how are we supporting these communities? How can we go in and provide meaningful services? And when our law enforcement goes out, you know, sometimes it was the dogs were bald because they went into the house because there's a flea infestation. That's not someone who doesn't love their animals. That's someone who can't afford astronomically priced flea treatment.
Right.
Or medical care. So as an organization, our board, our senior leadership started looking at, how are we going to shift so that we truly can serve our community in a meaningful way?
So we rebranded our outreach team to Animal and Community Centered Engagement Support Services. We are proactive instead of reactive, proactive instead of punitive. We have our law enforcement team. They work directly with our outreach team. They're out there. They are, again, as Kelly said, they're being proactive instead of punitive. We are taking situations where individuals have a severely matted dog, and in the past, that would be something we would charge them for animal cruelty. Now we're taking a look at it and saying, you know what, they just can't afford or don't have access to a groomer, and what can we do? Let's help them. So we have taken in dogs, we have groomed them, and then given them back to their owners. That is what we are doing now, and that is truly what is needed by the community. There are times, yes, when we need to be law enforcement, but the majority of the time we're there just to assist. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, we've found, is a better way, and that is the way the animal welfare community in general is shifting.
Mm-hmm. And in order to do this, you know, that leaves room in the shelter for the animals that truly yes. need us.
Mm-hmm.
But again, going into a community that is not trusting of outsiders, they're right. not trusting of, because there have been so many fly-by-night people coming in with a help. We had to go to some amazing partners, and we were really lucky to have partners like Rachel and her organization open up their doors and say, let me help you. I know this community. And we have a lot of barriers to overcome still on our own, because we were law enforcement going into that community for mm-hmm. a long time.
We and are so not Rachel welcome is our, at some point.
Yeah, let's bring Rachel in. Tell us about the work that you're doing and this kind of partnership with SPCA.
Sure. Resource Council's been around. I've been there a little bit over 3 years. They opened their doors in June of 2021, which is right off the back of COVID. And we like to serve whole families, and that includes pets. So we have programming, free programming, from after school to food markets to food pantries to after school summer camps. We do senior programming. We have yoga. We have basketball programs to keep kids off the street. So the East Side, again, is not a very trusting community with good reasons. So once mm-hmm. we showed, hey, we're here, we're staying, our doors are open, the pool's open, the gym's open, you know, come on in, and all the services are free. We just want everybody safe, healthy, and happy. I think that, again, serving a whole family counts with animals. It counts with kids. I've been in education for 23 years, so I see that a kid flourishes when their family is intact and has all the services and access to things that they need. So for us, it's just serving the whole family and community, because after TOPS happened, we were there day one. Mm-hmm. So we got to see, you know, how much people needed and how much they did need their animals. I mean, that is a support system. That's loyalty. That's love. People were hurting. We were all hurting. And then to, on top of it, say, I'm sorry you went through this. You now don't have access to food. Now your animals are going to suffer too. It's just, it's not fair. So when Tyler is part of the outreach, he came to me and he was like, hey, I saw what you guys do. You know, can we come in? And I was like, sure. And then he said, we're going to ask people what they need. And I was like, absolutely. Because so many people in high poverty neighborhoods are told what they need. Mm-hmm. And that's not okay. I don't agree with that. I never have. Even for our kids, like, what do you need? What do you want? What do you need from us? And how can we help you? So this was just a no-brainer.
And so this $100,000 grant from PetSmart Charities, it's an incubator program. But right now you are in phase one.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about phase one and then on to phase two.
So phase one is going into the community, and the focus of this part of phase one and this cohort is urban communities of color. And we are looking at building relationships with the actual community. And obviously there is a trust barrier, and something we are really trying to, gain the trust of the community. And by doing that, we are offering food, supplies, just being there. It doesn't even have to be, you know, we're here to provide vet care, and that's not something we have done as of yet. But we want to, we held focus groups. It's one of the first things that we did, just to find out what is their concern? What is their concern with safety in their community? What is it, the most important thing for them and their pet? How are pets important to them? Just finding that information. And then we took the focus group information and we had a survey built for us through the University of Denver IHAC program. And we are now in the process of surveying the community. What is it that they need? And that's the key to this point, is finding out what they need. And then phase two will be implementing the things that they needed. So it could be, actually, I don't even know. It could be they're interested in grooming, or maybe it's vaccinations are something that's super important to them. So we can hold vaccination clinics, or is it a mobile, you know, clinic for them? We have no idea. But once we do know, then we can go and work on providing that with the second phase.
And that's that was all that information is gained from those focus groups.
Yes, focus groups, surveys.
And when I read the surveys at first, you know, we've been working in this community for a long time. So we have an assumption, right? We assume people need free vet care. What we have been finding is that people are not asking for free vet care. So in the East Side as a whole, outside of this zip code specifically, we have been doing vaccine clinics. And what people have identified is they just want affordable access. They just want access.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, in looking at what our next steps are going to be, you know, the focus group also identified, I think a lot of times people will come in with this answer of, we should have a dog park. People love dogs, we should have a dog park. Well, one of the huge concerns of the people on the East Side is that so many animals aren't vaccinated. They don't want their dogs in a dog park with unvaccinated animals that are going to make them sick.
Behavior
was a huge concern. How do we train our animals? We don't have access to trainers. We don't have access to groomers.
And then what do we do to break down those barriers to make sure that the individuals, the community members, are able to access things that we could just go out and get easily ourselves?
And we have to look at income. We have to be realistic.
Absolutely.
We can't go in and say, we're going to spay and neuter everything on this block. Because there are people who make money off their animals. There are people who sell puppies, and that's how they make money. So we have to go in and overcome the misperceptions. We have to do a lot of education. And that's why we're doing the surveys and meeting with the community. Because we could meet with 15 people. They could say, I need vet care, and we can put a bus together and we could be there in 3 weeks. You know what I mean? Assuming our donors would support it. But we really want to look at every aspect of why people are making the decisions that they're making and understand them.
Exactly. And meet them where they are. And we're not there to judge or anything along those lines. If that's what they need, then that's fine. But how can we support you? Is there something we can do? And we know we can't do this alone. And it's so, we are so grateful to Rachel and the Resource Council, because honestly, we could not do what we're doing without them.
And so phase two would just be implementation of everything you got during the focus groups and everything else. And this is 3 years or 4 years?
Depending on our results, as long as we don't screw this up, they will fund us for 2 to 3 more years, depending on what we find. And that's a beautiful thing about working with PetSmart, is they really, really want to know what we need. And they're being responsive in the moment. Absolutely. With the funding. So we actually have gone in and we've hired people from this community. So we have our two leads from the SPCA who are going into the community, Tyler and Amy, who are working with Rachel. But we also are trying to hire people part-time from within the community to do some of this work.
Yeah, Rachel, can you talk a little bit about going into the community with two SPCA employees and the work you're going to be doing there?
Sure. Yeah. Honestly, a lot of people come to us. So twice a month, we have something called Resource Connection Day. So there's between 15 and 30 organizations that come in like a one-stop shop. So we have anything from National Fuel to HEAP to healthcare, legal services, things that people need but don't have transportation to get there. So you're not taking a bus to 15 different organizations that are placed all over the city of Buffalo. Sure, in a car, it's a 12-minute ride. On a bus, it could be 3 to 5 hours of your day if you have kids, if there's things you need to get home to. So just knowing that, and I told Tyler, I said, let me help you. Again, people come to us. They understand that the Resource Council is there to help in all aspects. Again, whole family needs. Let me be the face at first and bring you in. So when we did the focus group, it was like 2 hours of just asking questions of what do you need? There's surveys and questions that make sense. So just having the community understand that we are here, we are helping, and seeing all these new faces aren't scary, and knowing that they really are here to stay and listen, right? So people don't like being told what they need. They like to tell you what they need, right? Because they know what they need. So being in the community, just seeing our kids and our people, and again, it's 4 hours twice a month. People are in there, 100 to 300 people, farmers markets, the food pantry. It's just seeing the same people and seeing everybody else like, oh, I went here for this. Where'd you get that from? Or how do you do this? Or how do you get this? It's one area that is fully accessible to the east side by walking. If there's an issue, like they said, they can bring it to their, you know, Ruby, she just got a second dog. It's a Pomsky's for cute. But she doesn't have the access to take a 30-pound bag of dog food back to her house. So the SPCA will come and deliver it. So then the neighbors see like, oh, what do you got there? How did you get this? How do I get that? And then it just becomes word of mouth. Yeah. And then it becomes, oh, I can just walk down the street and get everything I need, from pet care to legal aid to my National Fuel bill, help with, you know, rental services. It's just a one-stop shop for an entire family and anything that you could possibly need.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here for just a minute. Some people might say, you know, wouldn't it be easier to provide vet access in underserved communities by putting, say, a PetSmart in these communities? Smack dab, maybe on Jefferson, maybe on Bailey, something like that. Because to my knowledge, there are no PetSmarts on Buffalo's east side.
No, and that's one of the things, to Stephanie's point, when people were talking to us, they said, we don't need access to food. We need access to healthy food for our pets. We need access to quality food. Would a, you know, a PetSmart in the neighborhood be great? Possibly. But PetSmart itself recognizes, and that's why they do this grant, that it may not be the answer. People may not be able to afford what's in that store. They may not be able to afford the veterinary care. The SPCA operates a low-cost veterinary clinic currently at our shelter called the Lipsy Veterinary Clinic. And we have a program called Oasis, where it's sliding scale. If you come in for, you know, you have a catastrophic emergency with your animal, when you take it to emergency vet, the only option is pay or euthanize, which sometimes the shelter gets a rep for that, but they don't realize that we are going to work to save these animals. And so we want that access to be available in all the communities. And we really do need to ask the community, what is helpful to you? What is helpful? because we could show up with a vet clinic.
Right.
Will people trust us enough to use it? I don't know. And we have to figure out what can people afford? That's the other part of this. Mm-hmm. What can people afford? We can make assumptions. We can work on sliding scale, but we have to look at how are we going to fund this and what can people afford? The other piece that we have to work with, you know, so we're working with the Resource Council. We're working with probably 30 different organizations throughout the city at this point. And we also have to work with our legislators. We also have to work with the people who are making these laws. So this is a broader issue, and the SPCA is doing what it can. But we also recognize mission creep. We also have donors that we answer to who really want to understand what we're doing, and we treat our donors as partners. But we need to say, what services are there in the community? What can we use and what can we expand on that's already happening? How can, you know, we've met with some legislators recently that say, okay, let's work together on this. Let's come together and say, how are we going to overcome the fact that there is not affordable housing that allows pets? There's not even unaffordable housing that allows pets, honestly.
Right. Right.
You know, you can pay $2,500 a month. They still don't want your dog.
I just want to circle back to just the issue of trust mm-hmm. when going into a new community and you know, making sure that that community realizes that, you know, you're here for the long haul. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think that's such a important part of what you guys do mm-hmm. and you know, other people that have come on this show before, just mm-hmm. being breaking down that trust and building it up.
I think so. One of the things, I was a social worker for many years before going into animal welfare, and I worked, you know, door to door in communities, and I didn't look like a lot of the communities that I worked in. And we're taking the lessons learned going into different communities, but it took us a while for people to realize who we were mm-hmm. as law enforcement and as the people who took their animals. It's going to take a while to change that.
Yes.
And we understand that. And that's why we know we're here for the long haul. Having people vouch for us in the community and just doing the good work that shows that we're showing up. Showing up at someone's door with a bag of food and seeing that those animals need additional help and not sending a law enforcement agent out is going to go a long way.
What can we do to support you? What can we do? Mm-hmm. And even just being there, it doesn't even, you know, we had a microchip clinic. There was hot dogs, food, just being at different community events, mm-hmm. tabling, you know, those are things that I think are truly important. Just
yeah, the visibility.
Them seeing our face. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a microchip clinic at the Resource Council, you know, a few weeks ago. And then I showed up at True Bethel Baptist Church for a vaccine clinic. And a woman walked up and said, I remember you. Yes, you do. Mm-hmm. So it's just making sure that we are visible, providing support, and not making assumptions, and just truly listening to the community members and asking, what do you need? And I think that truly will be
we're starting to see it. So mm-hmm. we were having a vaccine clinic. We have a vet tech that goes on the road with this outreach team. So she's phenomenal and is one of the most supportive people. She could talk to anybody. So a woman came over from across the street and just said, what are you guys doing? Now, she didn't bring an animal with her. We're clearly doing a vaccine clinic. So we start talking about what we're doing, the services that we could provide. And Sarah, who's our vet tech, went over to her and said, you know, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. We're here to support the community. And the woman still was very hesitant. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah was able to give her a collar and a harness for her dog because she didn't have it. And the woman was scared to bring us her dog because it had lost a bunch of fur. It had, we believe at that time, flea dermatitis. Mm-hmm. And she was terrified that if she brought this dog over to this vaccine clinic, we would say, you're not taking care of your dog.
Yeah, we're going to take your dog.
We're going to take your dog. So Sarah was able in that moment to gain some trust. We were able to get the dog over to the vaccine clinic. She was able to get some vaccines. She was able to get some pet food. And our veterinarian saw the dog and was able to say, this is what's going on and this is how we can help you. We pass out flea treatment. We actually have another case, and it wasn't an outreach case. It was a law enforcement case where we got called out to a house where we were called by an emergency vet clinic because a cat was brought to the vet clinic that had died. And it had died because of flea anemia. It was so infested with fleas. And we were able to go out, meet with the family, see what's going on. They had 9 other cats in the house. And don't quote me on the 9. But there were quite a few cats in the house.
Now that I say more than 2. Yes.
But we were able to go out, pick up all those animals, bring them back to our shelter, start treating them for the flea anemia. They needed fluids. They needed intense medical care. In the meantime, we were working with one of our community partners who provides flea extermination. We don't want it to stop right there. So we mm-hmm. have a community partner, Mosquito Hunters, that's lovely. And we called the owners and we said, here's what we're dealing with. They said, we're going to go in and treat this house for free. So the SPCA held on to the cats. We treated the animals. There were a few kittens that they didn't want returned to the house, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to rehome those kittens. And then the cats that they had, we made sure that they were completely up to date on everything. We've treated the house now. And they can go back. And the humans were suffering too. I mean, if your cats are that infested with fleas, so are you.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to send them home with additional flea treatment. And our law enforcement officers can go out and check on them and make sure everyone's still doing okay. And that's an example of the shift that we've had in law enforcement. Because before, we would have taken those 9 cats, years before, and charged those people.
It's changing the narrative.
It's changing the narrative. That's exactly it.
And within that, I mean, you say law enforcement, but does that name need a rebrand as well? Because, you know, when we think law enforcement,
right.
you know, we think in the negative.
So yes and no. We do have people who commit crimes against animals and need to be punished.
Yes.
So that's why we have rebranded and sort of split our law enforcement almost in half. Mm-hmm. So we have the access team, and then we have our humane law enforcement. And they are police officers. They are, you know, going out and enforcing animal cruelty laws.
Mm-hmm.
When they go out to a house and it is a true situation where the people just do not have what they need to take care of their animals, they are not punishing them. We are going through access. We're getting them into our clinic and we're getting these animals helped. But if we go out and this person just beat their dog or stabbed their dog,
right.
we are pressing charges.
That's right.
Because those people do need to be held accountable. So it's finding that balance, and we're still trying to mm-hmm. find that balance.
Now, do the officers, you know, if they come into a home, they assess the situation. Is that also like a red light, green light, yellow light mm-hmm. thing?
Absolutely. And the first thing they're going to do is provide support. Mm-hmm. If there is a way to keep an animal in their home and look at the need of the family and the animals, that's the first thing that they're going to do. They're going to work with the individuals. We know that animals are better off in their homes. But if it is a blatant cruelty situation, mm-hmm. then that's when they're going to charge and go further with
that. The other side of this is that shelters are in crisis right now. Shelters across the country are in crisis. We are inundated with animals because people are in crisis. And when people cannot afford to take care of themselves, they cannot afford to take care of their animals. We have seen across the country a drop in adoptions.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this with, you know, the triaging is not just how can we help, but also do we have space to help? So for us, when we have a full adoption floor and we're running all these promotions to try to find wonderful homes for these animals, it just makes sense. It makes business sense to keep pets in homes that they already know and love. You know, it's helping the community, but it's also helping the shelter, because we desperately need people to come in and show up and adopt our animals.
Got a few minutes left. I just want to ask, what's next for the SPCA? You know, after this grant, what's next? Where are you going to go?
Well, we are looking right now. This grant is focusing in on 14208. We want to stay within the city. So there are plenty of other places for us to take this model and look at other areas. And truly, we will remain in the city and we will continue asking, what does our community need and what can we provide?
And Rachel, what's next for the Resource Council of Western New York?
We're just going to keep plugging along, doing what we do. We have more programs now, and again, asking the community what they need. Our Thursdays are always hopping with a bunch of different organizations. So it's just, again, serves the entire family so that our community can keep growing and doing its best in serving families as a whole, from seniors to kids.
All right. This has been What's Next. I want to thank our guests, Kelly Wolf and Stephanie Pepper from the SPCA serving Erie County, and Rachel Terapaki from the Resource Council of Western New York. More What's Next to come after this brief message.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and joining me today is the CEO of the Western New York Women's Foundation, Sherry Scavone. Sherry, thank you for being with us today.
Sure, thank you.
So in 2010 and 2017, your organization released its Pathways to Progress report detailing the status of women in the Western New York region through data-driven analyses of issues like poverty, childcare, pay equity, education, leadership, and occupational segregation. All of these factors and more play a part in women's advancement in this country. What's the mission behind doing this analysis and creating the reports? And furthermore, what did you find in these earlier reports?
Sure. So we, you know, as an organization, our goal is to create change. And we believe that data is powerful, and that if we can put data out there and make a case based on data for people to consider, that we can change hearts and minds. And more importantly, that leads to changing systems, culture, and policy. You know, all of these issues that we as a community encounter and disproportionately impact women are really the surface of the real issues underlying them, which tend to be rooted in our systems, our old systems or old policies. And so we're always trying to drive change, not necessarily by us, but by legislators, by organizations, by elected officials, to really understand these issues and therefore do something about the issues that are disproportionately holding back individuals in our community, which unfortunately is more often than not women.
And how did you decide that these were the issues to focus on?
Well, they're certainly the issues that rise to the top. And so when we talk about disproportionate impact on women, things like occupational segregation, again, if you look at the data, you know, poverty, the impact of a disjointed and dysfunctional childcare system, the pay gap, those are all issues that have significant immediate and long-term impact for women and on the decision-making of women and really on their trajectory of a career, of a life. And so those are the things that we thought were most important. And this past year in May, when we released the latest report, and we were releasing another white paper each month in one of each of those six areas, we wanted to really take a deep dive into them because they were the six areas that really rose to the top in terms of disproportionate impact. And quite frankly, they all overlap each other as well.
Mm-hmm. Everything seems to be connected the more you dig. Real quick, for those who may not know, what does occupational segregation mean?
So occupational segregation, our report actually will come out in the fall on that. But it basically is that women or any population are directed into certain occupations. In the case of the women, and we talk about this also in poverty, it tends to be in the retail, hospitality, tourism, and really some of the lower hourly rate sorts mm-hmm. of that may not have benefits, may not have retirement plans. So again, affecting later on. And when you look at it, there's actually deep roots back into slavery and Black women's history of not being allowed to be teachers and not being allowed to be certain occupations. So we find ourselves segregated from that perspective, and also by virtue of the fact that many women are also trying to take care of children, also trying to manage a number of different factors in their family, and therefore may be segregated occupationally, again, tending to reside more in that hourly, low-wage sorts of occupations.
female headed families are more likely to live in poverty than any other types of family, especially in the city of Buffalo, where the poverty rate among female headed families is over 47%. It's a really astonishing number.
Yeah, and it's actually double the national average, and way above, you know, state or Erie County. And to us, that is certainly a glaring point that we have to do something about. And that is our Empower Initiative, trying to economically empower women through education opportunities, supported education programs, along with acknowledging their children and helping them with that piece. The other thing is that we there's a group, including Buffalo Niagara Partnership and the Western York Women's Foundation, and our local elected officials looking at the benefit cliff, which there's, you know, more and more people have heard of the benefit cliff, but, you know, basically people will turn down promotions, they'll turn down raises because they're afraid of losing critical support. Mm-hmm. So, I'll give you an example. In our Empower paid training program for certified nursing assistants, when they begin to begin the training, they are very quickly, potentially, depending upon other incomes, dropped from SNAP and dropped from some of the public benefits. And when you look at that, you know, you have to make a decision in your family. If you're somewhere and you're offered a $2 an hour raise, but that's going to put you over the cliff, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. we talk about. And you will therefore lose a housing subsidy or a childcare subsidy, although we've gotten that level very, very high. So that's the last thing to go now, thankfully. But you may lose, food, may lose housing is clearly the big one. You're not going to take that $2 an hour raise,
right,
to lose a $40,000 housing benefit, right? So we've got this huge problem, and we've actually been talking with a lot of other states about what they're doing. Erie County's been running a little pilot with a couple of companies where we bridge that gap and allow people to take those promotions and move up. The legislation that Senator Prasad and Senator Kennedy, when he was at the state, have been pushing is what's called a six-month income disregard. So essentially, it gives that person 6 months to begin work or upgrade their work. And it gives them what I call a humane 6 months to wean off of public benefits. But because that public benefit system is so antiquated and has not changed in so long and is, quite frankly, deaf to the realities of people and the increased minimum wage, to throw someone off their benefits is a disincentive.
Right.
To better themselves, right? You cannot blame someone for not wanting to give up a housing benefit,
you're
right?
Being punished, yes, for succeeding.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It seems like that issue can be mended with an expansion of social services programs or raising, as you said, raising of the maximum take home salary threshold,
right,
what have you. But as you said, the program is antiquated.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we get, is that just more through politics?
Yeah, it's really policy, and much of it comes from the federal level.
Yes.
So, just like childcare, the child care assistance program comes from the federal government. The state can put money in. The state can make some choices, on eligibility as they have. But much of the policy and funding for these public benefits come from the federal level. So this legislation, for example, the six-month income disregard, would, as I understand it, be something the state would have to pick up. Now, you could look at it as it's an additional 6 months of cost, or you can look at it as we're actually moving someone off of public benefit in 6 months. And mm-hmm. so there's a savings to the state. And it's, it's semantics, right? How are we looking at it when lawmakers are in Albany making decisions and everything costs money? How are we looking at a income disregard for 6 months to allow that weaning of public benefits? that's the battle we're currently up against.
And, you know, speaking about childcare, mm-hmm. last December, you were at the White House, mm-hmm. Participating in the Communities in Action event. The focus was childcare. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I have been enlightened and I guess happy that the current administration understands that childcare is infrastructure. Right. Mm-hmm. I often say you can't get to work without roads that, you know, are passable, and you can't get to work without a safe, developmentally appropriate place for your children to be. And, you know, childcare is in a crisis right now. We do not pay the childcare providers, again, mostly women in the state, mostly women of color. Because of deep roots in sexism and racism, and quite frankly, again, back to the days of slavery when women took care of children. And so whether it's taking care of children or our elders or our less abled populations, those positions are not paid well. They actually, most of the childcare providers qualify for public benefits because they make under 200% of the federal poverty level. So we're not paying our providers who are taking care of our kids in their most formidable first 3 years of their life. And so they're going other places, mm-hmm. you know, fast food places that have revenue. And we're seeing a lot of centers or at least classrooms closing. About 90% of providers in the state are saying they have classrooms that are sitting there fully ready to go, but they can't staff them. And so it's not a good, and it's prohibitively expensive for parents. So it's right. You know, up to $15,000 a year for an infant per infant. And so we have this like crisis on all fronts. It's not affordable for parents. It's not accessible for parents because places are closing. And as a small business of, you know, women owned small businesses, which is most of our childcare system in the state, they can't make enough to actually make the business run. So it's a, you know, it's a huge crisis that adds to poverty because women can't go to work, or they're making the choice to continue going to work, but they're expending more than they are in housing and mortgages in childcare and just trying to figure it out. The childcare assistance program is super helpful, and we've been able to increase the eligibility for that program significantly. Mm-hmm. So families can get help if they can find a childcare center, right? It's a vicious circle. So, you know, all of the childcare plays a major, major role. And, you know, the White House in December, and again, just last month when I was back for the chamber, they understand the role that childcare plays in our infrastructure. But it's a tough sell. Again, we're not, you know, that is not in a paternalistic society as the United States is. You know, funding and supporting childcare has not yet risen to the right level of health benefits and some of the other really important things. And so we're really trying to work with businesses also to say it's really important that you start looking at childcare and supporting childcare businesses in your community as an asset, supporting childcare for your employees if you want them to, you know, to be there. We have for the last 10 years been working to bring childcare to the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, where, mm-hmm. you know, some 15, 16, 17,000 people work, critical work that we want to make sure that the 80 to 90% of care providers who are women can be on the floor when we need them, providing the role and in the OR and doing everything they're doing. And yet, you know, in the grandiose plan for the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, a child care center was not part of that. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to the thinking, and we really have to start thinking. And the administration put forth the CHIPS Act. So anyone who accepts money for manufacturing, such as Micron in the Syracuse area, has to have a plan for childcare. So we're starting to see that. At the U.S. Chamber meeting last month, Chobani, who's in the North Country here, was there. Micron was there. Corning Glass was there, because they all recognize that they have to be talking about and doing something about childcare if we're going to lift people out of poverty and if we're going to have people to work, quite frankly, and run the businesses.
Right. And it has a
positive economic impact?
The ROI on childcare is minimally $2 to every dollar. There are some, the Minnesota Federal Reserve actually suggests about an 18% ROI. Nothing the state can invest in has an ROI like childcare does. But again, it takes political will. It takes a complete shift in thinking from, as I say, the, you know, Ozzie and Harriet Leave It to Beaver, you know, you go off to work and you come home and June has taken care of the kids and has the, it's just not how our families work anymore.
Right.
Particularly, you know, single mother, head of household families. And so we have to recognize that mm-hmm. and say, first of all, jobs don't go from, you know, 7 to 3 the way, you know, school does, or 7 to 2. And you know, we have to do something to support childcare as an infrastructure. And, you know, the White House received that message. They have, again, put forth some policies. The Build Back Better bill was tremendous, did not pass, but it was a tremendous acknowledgement of recognizing the real issue for around childcare. Just, you know, as a point of history, in 1970, we actually had bipartisan Congress passage of a universal child care bill that was vetoed by then President Nixon. And so, you know, here we are, how many years later, 50 years later, still having this conversation, when we know during World War II, when we needed women to work, we had to set up child care. Buffalo, New York, first child care center in the United States, Mariah Love. And yet, you know, here we are in 2024, still having this conversation.
Can you talk a little bit about the partners you collaborated with on this report and kind of just in general with the Western New York Women's Foundation?
Yeah, we always, our big thing is collaboration. So, you know, even if our advocacy work is done in concert with different coalitions, the Empire State Campaign for Child Care, we're part of the Coalition for the Equal Rights Amendment that's on the ballot right now. We're part of a coalition for some women's policy issues, and we're part of the Women's Funding Network nationally. So we learn from each other across the state. So, you know, working with others and collaborating and pulling those teams together, if you will. These are, as we like to say, hairy, audacious problems. These are big problems. There's, and with little nuances. And so it really is pulling teams together of all of those, including the individuals who have the lived experience, to be able to inform all of these. We are lucky to have a part-time knowledge management officer, because our history, you know, has always been rooted in data, who is brilliant at pulling together the data from a number of different sources, including the U.S. Census and others. And then she and an aspiring young woman from the University of Buffalo who just graduated tried to tell the story in each of these white papers of and driving solutions. So we don't like to just say, hey, there's a problem. Here's the data about the problem. We like to talk about the solutions. So, you know, acknowledge the problem. Poverty is a problem. Why is it a problem? What's the root cause? And then what can we do about that? And that's how these reports are laid out. They are all on our website. The first one in March, which is kind of the overview, the look back and look forward. Mm-hmm. And then the white papers on each of the six areas that disproportionately impact women. Three of them are up. I should say three will be coming this fall. And with each of them, including the three this fall, we do a 1-hour virtual education session that have been really well received as part of releasing each of the subsequent reports.
And will there be another full report in 7 years, or will you keep doing, you know, every... with, you know, three issues in a bunch.
Yeah. We, you know, we have always updated, we used to call them fact sheets. So we've always made sure our website was, you know, we want to be the voice for women and girls in Western New York. We're really the only organization solely dedicated to lifting voice and driving solutions for women. And, And so we want, you know, you talk about collaboration, we want to be able to provide this data for the media, for legislators, for other organizations. And so we've always had this on our website. We called them fact sheets before. What format they'll take, you know, not sure going forward after 2024. But we will continue to update and elevate these really deep issues that we all should be talking about, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to change the conversation around the dining room table, around the boardroom table, around the, you know, tables in Albany, so that we all understand these issues and understand that there are solutions if we have the political will and really drive to see them through.
And there are many programs that help people living below or at the poverty line, but are there any organizations or entities that stand out to you?
Well, I think people find support in their communities, right? I think the faith-based communities play a really important role in identifying resources. We, as part of our Empower from Education to Employment program, have actually created a list of resources with key people we know in each one of them. Last night, we had an issue with a woman who had applied for WIC 3 times and was just not getting anywhere. And so we instantly could make a call to someone who immediately knew the answer. And, you know, today she's doing what she needs to do to get that. So, you know, we try to be a resource, but that resource is all of our partners. So I don't think there's any one, and maybe that's, you know, an issue for this community. There isn't any one organization that I would say, you know, go to. We do, on the Western York Women's Foundation website, we do have a page that says where to get help. Mm-hmm. And we try to cover a lot of areas. We recently brought 13 organizations in together that all are in the domestic violence space, which unfortunately is an issue for us and for this community. And you know, we wanted to understand what they each do differently, what their area of expertise and focus, and who to call at each one of their sites. And so we've added some of that to our website as well. 211 is certainly a clearinghouse that anyone can use and to call 211 and ask for assistance. And that's probably a great starting point. Again, we're happy to provide directions either by our website or, you know, giving us a call as well.
Yeah. And I would be remiss if I didn't add that also on your website is a directory for supporting women-owned businesses.
Yes. Yeah. So part of our All In initiative to lift women into positions of leadership was recognizing that there were things employers could do, and we have very specific metrics for them. There's things that young women who want to lead can do, and that's our Ready, Set, Lead program, which is recruiting right now for a cohort that'll start in December. And that women as business owners were leaders in of themselves and of the community. And so we weren't able to do what we had originally planned to do because of COVID. But we said, you know, we need to keep these women-owned businesses alive and open during a pandemic. And so we created this women-owned business directory. Any women-owned business does not have to be a certified women-owned business, can just fill out the form on our website. We vet them, and then it is on our women-owned business directory, which we highlight and amplify. We've, in fact, part of our 25th anniversary, selected 25 businesses at random to amplify even more. And then we direct people to use that that business directory, women-owned business directory, when they need things. Someone last week said, oh, wow, I called someone who I needed a cake for a birthday. And I called this woman and it was fantastic. And so that's really what we're trying to do is, you know, supporting these women-owned businesses that are so important to our community is a really easy way to access them. And it's by service. So it's, you know, if you're looking for a cake decorator, that's, you know, that's in there under that service.
My last question for you, pretty basic, pretty broad. Where do you see the Western New York Women's Foundation in the next 25 years?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we, as I said at the beginning, have to amplify the face of change. And, you know, certainly I think our magic mix of giving voice to the issues that are, you know, data-driven voice of amplifying the issues of advocacy, and then of very specifically focusing on women, advancing women into leadership and on women's economic mobility. I think we have to amplify that as well, right? We have to duplicate those efforts and expand those efforts. And, you know, it would be my goal for our employer cohort, for All In, that, you know, we have 300 businesses that are coming together and saying, yep, you know, we've done this, we're all on the same page, we're supporting each other, women are critically important, and, you know, these are the things we're going to do. The other thing is, we have talked a long time and are beginning to kind of put into play, how do we engage men as allies in all mm-hmm. of this work? Because this isn't, you know, men against women.
Right.
And again, we all benefit if we're doing it together. So that has to be part of our future, as well as some other initiatives that we do have on tap.
All right. Well, I look forward to following this up for the next 25 years.
This is What's Next. I want to thank our guest, Sherry Scavone, the CEO of the Western New York Women's Foundation, for being with us today. This is WBFO News and Buffalo, Toronto Public Media.